Joe presents Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby, together with Guinness.
Hello and you're very welcome to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby here on Joe together with Guinness. We have a loaded show for you today. We'll be joined by Ulster and Ireland winger Jacob Stocktail for a chat about his meteoric rise to stardom, and also he'll be talking about a fundraising initiative that he is supporting during the COVID-19 crisis. We've also got some actual rugby news that we'll be jumping into, and we'll be taking you back to 1995 for a big nostalgic kick in the ghoulies, where we'll be talking about Braveheart, What's the Story, Morning Glory, and England versus New Zealand in the semi-final of the 1995 World Cup in South Africa, Johannesburg, to be correct. So when I think about that time, I think about Braveheart first, coming first, being flung out into the world by Mel Gibson, just like at the end when Brendan Gleeson's character picks the sword and just fucks it with reckless abandonment. No need for historical fact or reason or anything. Just you imagine, like, he's got all these history buffs that are there that Randall Wallace has maybe hired to maybe just dot their I's and cross their T's to make sure that they're some way within history boundaries. And Mel Gibson's just running around like, no, what if he does this? What if he does this? And then they make it really long, so they've got like some bits they can cut out, but then he just grabs it and just fucks it like the sword. You're like, oh no. Oh God, what have
that
we
done? That was the dildo being thrown from McCall's head, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, I maybe use that reference a bit too often.
Yeah.
The dildo was thrown by O'Connell with just the equal amount of reckless abandonment as Braveheart was hurtled out into the world. Who gives a shit how many generations this is going to influence or how many heads this dick is going to land on?
One at a time, hopefully. Anyway, listen, that reminds me, the Braveheart thing. I remember watching it back. There was some reference to O'Connell and Hayes throwing stones at each other, but we'll get into that. Okay, I just remember you bringing it up, and I was like, there's something in my head, this is triggering something here, and I can't quite remember.
I've forgotten about it already, so I can't wait till you remind me.
Yeah, no, we'll get into that. We'll get into that. But before that, we need to do a little bit of housekeeping. Just a quick reminder that we have a new Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby YouTube channel. Each week, the video version of our show is going to go up. It can be found on the YouTube channel. The channel will feature our show each week, some best bits from each episode, and exclusive videos and cartoons. Our best movie moments went up last week, which I watched that, and I think I hope people understand that we are not taking ourselves as seriously as we appear to. We certainly are not movie critics. But people are falling for it.
Yeah, yes. I think that's season 3. We're proper movie critics. Season 4, I think we'll get into economics and then we'll see how we go from there.
Yeah. So people are falling for it. We've got 500 people subscribed already. I don't know what they see, Barry. I don't know about you. So please do continue to keep falling for it.
Have you seen what people watch on YouTube with people? Like, I walk into my brother's house and there's the kids just watching other kids playing with toys or grown men playing with toys. So look, if they can do it, we can talk shite about movies. So
yeah, we can compete. Fair enough.
There's no ceiling with this stuff, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, look, to take us back into that feeling of nostalgia. I love nostalgia. I'm a devil for nostalgia, but only when it's really beneficial.
Nostalgia.
Yes, nostalgic RFU token piece of free plastic that they gave us back in the day when they had no money. So I had the most nostalgic dripping week ever. My parents' house is within 5 kilometers of a walk from here. So every day during the beautiful sunshine, I'd walk to my parents' place and have barbecue at the back. And then I went for a swim in the Shannon every day, which I haven't done since I was a kid. And we just chatted and walked around my parents, when I grew up, on a beautiful kind of spit of land that is either side of it. It has the Shannon running kind of like a, yeah, it's like a sands bit, but it's not sand. It's called the Mill Road. So there's a mill at the end of it, and there's just a walkway that goes around, which is quite overgrown. You'd never see anyone down there. And I was just walking around there going, my goodness, I remember this so well. And I was just thinking, like, why don't we do this more often? Why don't we take advantage of our local surroundings? And it brings me back to that island life vibe that I was talking about a few weeks ago when we were talking about Jack Johnson's In Between Dreams and how the Irish people, we're bred and built and made for living that kind of laissez-faire lifestyle of just chilling and relaxing and not driving ourselves mental by working 12-hour days for big corporations and then spending the rest of our day driving to wherever we live on this big commute. Why can't we just chill out? And I think the main reason for that, when things are normal, is that we all have this kind of FOMO or this fear that we like, oh God, we need to be, this guy's doing it, so I need to be doing it. And this, we've driven ourselves a bit mental from it. But now that we're all aware that no one else is doing anything, that we're all kind of like, yeah, I can just chill. I don't need to get up and do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the pressure of yeah. if there's something going on out there that's better than what I'm doing here. And it's also social media as well, and we'll get into that with Jacob a little bit, because I know he's took a Twitter detox. Basically, I think he's more or less took a Pat detox, I think, because Pat was abusing him during the World Cup.
Pat's getting beatings, yeah.
So he's done that, but more in general, that social media thing about just feeling like there's stuff going on out there and people are having more fun.
I think people are still probably doing more, they're being less disciplined with the social distancing than their social media is letting on, but because they can't post it because they're afraid they'll be getting to get abused by people you're not looking at people on social media doing loads of different things. You're just happy enough to sit in the garden and just chill the beans.
Yeah.
So when I was on these walks, I got this nostalgic trip back to when I was but a 15, 16, 17 year old and flirting with young love and then watching normal people coming to a conclusion last night. It all just triggered that part of my life. Do you remember that well when you were, God, trying to mature? Like, I think the whole show is about maturing, is it? A relationship maturing from
coming of age.
Yeah. When you're supposed to be an adult at 17, but you're not really an adult at 17, but the world is telling you that, okay, it's legal for you now to have sex. It's, and then you're supposed to be physically, mentally, emotionally developed, but clearly you're not. You're the opposite. Your brain isn't probably fully developed till your mid 20s. But we put all these pressures on ourselves that we've to kind of get in relationships, and man, that's an awful time to be alive when you've to, when I can remember being like getting into relationships and thinking, how do I, is this it now? Do I have to do this for the rest of my life? Am I married? I'm only 17. How do I, and then you're mad about the person, but you, how do you get out of that? It's or do you get out of it? Or is it good for you? Or is it bad for you? And you can't really ask for anyone's opinion because they're afraid. They're like, oh, except yeah. For,
but we would have thought
that stupider mate.
We would have always thought that the mate in school that was in a really steady, serious relationship when you're 15, 16, 17, you kind of thought, like, even then, you're like, well, this guy's taking this so seriously. Why are they doing this? Even then, you're like that, yeah. To be fair. And that, I think that's maybe the unrealistic thing about normal people. They're not normal. They're weird people. To be fair, you know, like they're clever, true, yeah. They're really clever, and it's a little bit, I think we talked about this before, it's a little bit Dawson's Creek-y, and they're all experts on life. They're probably doing they're the equivalent in Sligo of what we're doing with our movie reviews, just thinking they know everything there is to know. A little bit opinionated, I would say. I think it's unrealistic that Connell would have been as popular as he was in school.
Why? Because he was very good at sport, though.
Yeah, But that's,
and he's good looking.
That's not enough, especially now. So back when we were in school, it was good enough to be good at sport. It's back to 22 Jump Street. Jonah Hill and what's his name? Channing Tatum.
Mm.
Channing Tatum was just the meathead jock, and we were obviously the meathead jocks in school because we were good at rugby. So that was good enough, like, to, you know, to be in a cool crowd. But I think nowadays it's different. Jonah Hill's the cool kid now, not Channing Tatum, and he was Channing Tatum.
I know, but I think in normal people, he, I think the why Connell is popular and why he's happy in the school environment and then he's unhappy in college is that he's grown up with all these people around him. So they know him from when he was a kid. So he doesn't really have to, I don't know, he doesn't have to show off. He's good enough. He's good at sports. So they take him for that. He's a bit quiet. He's, but he's intelligent. So people are probably less judgmental because they kind of know him well. And, but then Marianne is, very odd, so they judge her from the get-go. They're like, who is this one? So she grows into that, and then when they go to college, he really struggles because his identity is attached to what people think of him in Sligo, whereas she can abandon that and become herself. But I know what you mean about them being abnormal people. I suppose she had to do that a little bit, to make it more interesting. But
the thing that I picked up actually, this is a bit of a douchey thing to say. The book actually highlights, you know, that's annoying, right? So fair enough. But when you watch the series, when you watch the series, you're inclined to think that Connell, whenever he's quiet, he's confidently quiet and he's happy. He's just content in who he is. But when you read the book, then you get more of an appreciation of a little bit of turmoil that's going on in the background with him, and how he's not actually confidently quiet. He's nervously quiet. He doesn't know how to act, doesn't know what to say. Feels like he is obviously the beginnings of someone, you know, who then kind of struggles with depression on down the line. But, you know, I think you get more of an appreciation of that, which was really eye-opening, I thought.
Mm, yeah, I'm getting that now. I'm halfway through the book and I am getting that. Yeah, he does. He definitely, he comes across like less damaged in the show until that feckin' 9th and 10th episode.
Yes.
When they drop the bomb. But it finished well, man. I was happy. It was heartbreaking that they were obviously going to break up. But it finished on a positive vibe. They got back together. They had a brilliant sex scene at the end. Connell, his chain, right, obviously he's going to be an influencer with that, but he's got a serious set of pubes on him.
He's a big old bush, isn't he?
I wonder, will that, he's matured in the bush area anyway. I wonder, will he become an influencer with that as well?
Yeah, well, it's hard to be an influencer in that area, isn't it?
I don't know, like, lads be looking at that going, like, because he's all over the place now. People are taking photos of him walking around his GA shorts and stuff like that. But lads are going to look at that and they'll be like, geez, I've been trimming my pubes, but I better let them.
It's a more subtle version of being an influencer. You can't put a picture up on Insta. You can't say, link in bio.
Just take a peek into his trousers.
Yeah, not bad.
Yeah. Well, look, yeah, I was delighted with how it ended. And I've been looking into Sally Rooney a little bit, the author. She's an interesting lady. And I think she might be on board. She's a bit of a Marxist, actually. She's very against capitalism and consumerism. So I think she is also on board for my island lifestyle, this kind of colony or what do I want to call it? This way of life that I'm going to start. So myself and Sally Rooney.
I feel like you were going to invite me, and then I didn't really.
I've lost confidence already.
No. I'll join you and Sally.
No, myself, Jacob, Sally, and Jack Johnson.
Well, who's going to look after the kids? Don't send them up north, but don't send them to my house. I've already got too many.
All right, rugby. There's been a fair bit of rugby news this week. Super Rugby, how do you even say this word? Aotearoa, yeah. New Zealand, basically.
Yeah, I was delighted that that was thrown over to you for that. I had no clue. Never heard of it.
So the basically the Super Rugby in New Zealand is starting this weekend, and they have brought in some new rules, which I think are very interesting. Drawn matches will now be settled by a golden point. So after the end of the game, if it's drawn, they'll play 10 minutes where a team can, a team whoever scores try, penalty, whatever, drop goal, will win the game. If after 10 minutes it doesn't come to a conclusion, then each point team will get 2 points, correct? Yeah,
we're 24 years playing football in that, aren't we? Didn't they bring in the golden goals in Euro 96?
Yeah, that was just for like, I don't know if that even stayed. Did that stay? Because it's not happening in World Cups anymore.
No.
Yeah, but this is just regular league games, which is very interesting. Obviously, New Zealand rugby is a step ahead of everyone when it comes to excitement and energy, and they're just, you couldn't look for a more entertaining game of rugby, but yet they're still trying to push the boat out, and because it's obviously something to do with the fans not being engaged, and no one being happy with a draw. They want winners. They also have brought in probably the more controversial one, a player that gets red carded can be replaced by a fresh player after 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Which obviously their reasoning was that a red card was going to influence a game, or had been influencing a game too much. So let's just keep it as, you know, a 20-minute penalty. Obviously the player will get the same repercussions from World Rugby if it was a fairly dangerous tackle or anything like that.
I think that that player should be replaced by a spectator. I think they should shake it up even further.
Like a big claw comes out from the crowd and just goes down like and pick,
picks one up. Picked by the opposition.
Yeah.
So they get to say, that fella, he's playing. No,
just the claw, like as if you were in a computer arcades place and the claw just drops in. And I'm like, shit. A big old lad, overweight old lad just dropped in, still with his beer in his hand.
only like the claw machine. He never quite makes it to the pitch. He always just gets dropped just in the terrace before he gets to the advertising board. Oh, nearly had him.
Look, I think that one's going to be interesting. I don't know how it'll go down. To be honest, I like it. I do like a game when teams go to 14 men. For example, when Yi beats South Africa a few years ago down to 14 men. I mean, when a team does that, that lives forever when you can achieve something of as like that. But it does, I suppose, in the long run, make it less impactful to have a one player ruin the game for everyone involved, everyone watching, etc. Because I suppose 14 men winning a game happens very seldom. Last piece of rugby news. David Humphreys is departing from Gloucester Rugby the end of June, stepping down as director of rugby in light of head coach Johan Ackerman's departure, in order to give Gloucester the chance of a fresh start. Wonder where he'll go now. Would you be in touch with him very often?
We had planned to get him. We were trying to get him on the show. So I called him last week, but I never heard back. It was obviously, it would have been great to have had him on now with the news. He's, very well thought of anywhere he's been. I'd be surprised if he didn't have a plan, I suppose. So yeah, I don't know. That was news to me. Yeah, great fella and adds a lot. I don't know if maybe he's kind of joined to Ackerman or they kind of come as a pair. I don't know. But yeah, bit of a loss for Gloucester, I would have thought.
Yeah, I've watched a good bit of his old footage over the last few weeks just because he's on TV, or those old games are on TV. And I loved that time of Irish rugby. There was so much excitement. Obviously, Raj coming through, still pretty young, I think, when Humps was in his prime. So it was really the Humps show. Like, I watched him play Ireland play New Zealand, I'm going to say 1997 or something like that. And they're winning for 60 minutes of the game. And he is just controlling everything, kicking at goal really well, kicking to touch really well and just has a brilliant little show-go break that he just pulls out every once in a while. Good distributor. You kind of forget how good he was because Raj took over in such a dominating style when he did.
We wouldn't, anybody up here wouldn't forget how good he is, to be fair. He'd be a real hero up here, to be fair. I loved David Humphreys growing up. And a friend of mine then, I'd played for Irish Schools in Upper Sixth. And a friend of mine, my dad got a picture of David Humphreys at the rugby club one night in a raffle or something. And then a friend of mine sent it off to David Humphreys and he signed it and gave it back to me. And congratulations on your selection for Irish Schools. Look forward to seeing how your rugby career progresses. And this went up on my wall. And then fast forward 2 years, 3 years. And then I was playing week in, week out with Humph, and it was class experience.
I remember getting a rugby ball. Munster played Harlequins in a cup match and the ball went into the stand and like the lovely little Limerick lad I was, I shoved it up my jumper and stole it basically. But it was the one that had the big H on it. It was that real lovely old school Gilbert. And after the game, Woody was coming out of the dressing room and I waited around. It must have been 14, 15. And got Woody to sign it. I even remember him looking at it kind of going like, you've definitely stolen this ball. And I was like, yeah, what are you going to do? So he signed it and I took it on the holidays with me that summer and I called it the ball Woody. Such a bit of a loser. But I was over in Portugal. I would be down by the pool and tossing the ball around. And if the ball went near the water, I'd be like, Woody! Because his name would, the autograph would come off it. So I was like,
Wilson!
I get so ratty. There's all these other kids around the pool wanting to play, but I was like, don't let the ball go near the water. You can't rub off that. But then Martin Curry and Austin Healy arrived to the pool one day. They must have been after the Lions in 97 because they were fucking stratospheric in terms of like stardom. And I was like, oh my God, they arrived, big, massive rip lads. And I was in the pool and I saw my dad going over and with my ball and got the two of them to sign the ball. And I was like, no, they're ruining it. So I was in the pool trying to wash off their signatures on it, off it. And I think I did, yeah. Sorry, just catapulted. See, I love nostalgia. Just catapulted me back into it. Just like the sword from Braveheart. But let's get Jacob Stockdale on the phone.
You're listening to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness.
Okay, we've got Jacob Stockdale here. Jacob, how is isolation treating you?
For me, it's been pretty good. It's just like, been a nice opportunity to slow down for a couple of months and just kind of learn a new way to live, I guess. So yeah, I've been enjoying it.
We've got three kids and as a result I've sped up during isolation. how does a dog compare to three kids?
I take her for a run and then she sleeps the rest of the day. I don't know if kids do that.
Do you? Do you sleep for the rest of the day as well?
Near enough, yeah.
Yeah, I wish it was that easy. Tell me, what have you been up to? How have you found it, writing off the whole process? We were talking earlier on about bringing back kind of a new approach to life and kind of rediscovering what's important to ourselves rather than busying ourselves with our work day. Not that you know anything about a work day, Jake. You youngsters. But have you made any kind of discoveries about yourself?
First, like I find myself just missing going for like coffees with the lads a lot. They're kind of just small, simple things. And then that kind of pushed me on to realize just how important coffee is in my life, Like I wake up thinking about it now instead of just like grabbing it at some point during the day. It's become a main motivation. So that's an interesting point.
Wait till you have three kids, then it's going to become even more important. What is your go-to coffee then? Go on.
I'd say flat white. Flat white's my go-to. I'm trying to do the latte art, but I'm 3 months in now, and I think I might have got worse.
We got a hot tip from Tag Burn last week. Get a really expensive coffee machine. That's the mistake I made. For a retired sports person, I got what I would describe as an expensive coffee machine, and he put that to shame.
Absolutely.
By more than doubling it. What have you got yourself, Jacob?
I've got one of the wee Sage.
Barista Pro?
I've honestly no idea. When I bought it, it was about 400 quid, so I don't know if that's... Is that Tag Burn level, or is that the level?
Tag Burn's coffee machine is more expensive than my car, basically.
I see. I love coffee, but you know what? I'll keep drinking my puddle water before I'll spend a couple of grand on a coffee machine.
Yeah. I know. I love coffee, but I only love it as much as me being tight allows me to kind of push the boat out on it a little bit. But apparently, anyway, the hot tip from Tag Burn was the Sage machines are very difficult to get the milk frothy enough to make good latte art.
There you go.
Yeah.
So destined to fail is what you're saying.
Well, that is a negative interpretation of what I said. I was trying to kind of reassure you that all is not lost. You can just try harder, really, or it's an excuse for you. But tell me what else you've been up to. You're talking about getting out of bed for your coffee. So I'm just seeing this kind of get up and go, revitalize Jacob Stockdale. And then can you tell us a little bit about your Twitter detox?
My what?
You're on a Twitter detox, I believe. You're on
a quitter detox, and I was like,
yeah, I think you need a quitter detox, Jacob. That's not what you need. You're fine. You're going great.
Yeah, the Twitter detox actually has been going for a long time now. I don't really suppose that. Well, actually, I suppose nobody has really noticed because I wouldn't have been a big tweeter anyway. Tweeter, yeah, I think that's the right term. But it was just after directly after the World Cup, that first Munster game. I came back and played after the game, before even texting the friends, family. A girlfriend, I just went straight on to Twitter to see what people were saying about me, and I was just like, yeah, I was like, this is incredibly unhealthy. I just deleted the app off my phone, and I think I hadn't planned on maybe deleting it permanently. I just like, right, I need a bit of a break from this, but I haven't been on about 7 or 8 months, and to be honest, I'm not really planning on going back on it anytime soon.
Can you tell us a bit more then about, we're not looking for exactly what people were saying, but give us a bit more insight into the opinions of some of the people. I read you mentioned there, if you're sick, you don't just walk down the street and ask a randomer, what do you think's wrong with me? And that's the equivalent of, you know, random punters just getting in touch on Twitter. But tell us a little bit about that, because I experienced something similar. I was just always so nosy. I just was always so intrigued to see what people said, which is so unhealthy. Tell us a bit more about that, Jacob.
It obviously varies massively. You'd get the classic Twitter trolls that would be like tweeting you like horrible stuff, being like, you know, like kill yourself,
fucking hell.
Really offensive stuff. Those didn't bother me that much, weirdly enough, because I knew they were just saying these things to get a reaction, and it probably wasn't their actual opinion. Do you know, they were just like out there trying to get a bite out of you. So that those didn't really bother me that much. But it was
more... Did you like those ones?
Yeah. No, it was more the ones that would people would be like, their genuine opinion was I was like a crap rugby player. Those were the ones that would actually really get to me, which is weirdly enough. But yeah, they just ranged from, people saying that I didn't have a good game, to I shouldn't be playing for Ulster, I shouldn't be playing for Ireland, to, you know, I don't want, like, I'm tired of seeing Jacob Stockfield doing this or doing that. And, like, you know, like, 9 times out of 10, you'd read them and you'd go, I don't think, you know, they don't know as much as I do, and their opinion isn't actually right. But at the same time, when you're reading these tweets over and over and over and over and over again, you start to create a narrative in your head that they're actually right. So yeah, just decided that it wasn't a healthy thing to be doing, and decided just get rid of it.
You ever find yourself looking at their profiles and kind of just intrigued to see, okay, who is this person? Let's find out a little bit about them. How bad are their lives, maybe, or how, you know, like
sometimes it doesn't hurt as much if you go on and they're like, all right, Larry, yeah, he's only got 2 followers. He doesn't even have a picture. Do you know what I mean? You're like,
it's fascinating that the human nature, like, that we'll, you know, you've obviously, on the flip side, you would receive massive praise on a regular day when you go out and do your job for Ulster in Ireland. It's normally like, my God, you know, what Ireland's answer to Jonah Lomu for parts of your career. We're like, what have we've got struck gold with this guy? And I'm sure that would outweigh the negative comments by 100 to 1. But human nature is, we take in the negative ones so much more to heart than we would the positive ones. And I heard Russell Brand and what's his name, Conan O'Brien, talking about this the other day, and they're talking about it almost like it's currency. And you know, it's like when the Deutschmark became just, you know, lost all its value. It was like a 200,000 Deutschmark to buy a carton of milk, and it was like completely blown out. It's like, that's the same with the currency of a like for a not a like, or a negative comment against a positive comment. It just weighs it down so much. And yeah, I think fair play to you, man, for acknowledging that it's a narrative thing that you kind of end up telling yourself. But like, do you still take that on board? Sports psychologist in Ulster rugby that has helped you with that, or is that something you just adapted yourself?
No, there actually wasn't really a sports psychologist in Ulster that I worked with. I did a wee bit with Enda Kenny, or not? Sorry, Enda McNulty.
Enda
Kenny.
He's the physio, isn't he?
He's the former Taoiseach of Ireland.
Yeah, Leo Varadkar called me up. sorry, Ed McNulty, who's a sports psychologist in Ireland, did a few sessions with him, but no, it was very, very much something I just figured out on my own. It was just something that I decided, like, that I needed to do, or that I needed to do for my own, like, just well-being. And yeah, I'd say there was a few, like, there's definitely a few, like, trial and errors in the sense, like, because you know, I went through a period where I'd read all those comments and, like, I'd get angry about them, and they'd kind of motivate me to play better. But then, you know, when you read all those comments and you don't have a great game, and then there's more comments, it really backfires on you. So yeah, I decided to just, like, the best way is just to ignore it.
It surprises me that there's not more structure put in place for rugby players, like, to protect you from that. Like, it was never there. It was never that prevalent when I played. Twitter was only really just starting, but you had to deal with journalists more than anything, or the hurler in the ditch. But you never really went and bought the papers. It's a lot easier to just look up your phone and see this stuff. So I'm surprised. I mean, if you were to give advice to any young lad coming up now, would it be to just avoid it completely, or is there a way of, you know, kind of managing yourself through it?
Yeah, like, whenever I was coming up through, like, everybody said they just don't read anything about yourself. I don't think Tremby ever told me that, but that's probably because he didn't want me to do too well.
I was like, read more, Jacob. And then I'd be tweeting him directly.
You can fake accounts. No, like, there would have been boys, like, I remember Rubesti telling me, like, just don't read anything about yourself whenever. It was just after the 2018 Six Nations, and like at that point I was kind of like Bestie, like, you know, I'm going to read stuff about myself because it's all great at the moment, and I suppose it's going to be whenever it starts to not be great every single time you step on the pitch is when you start to you know, that's when it starts to affect you. So yeah, my advice would be the same as it was for me. Was just don't read anything, and do that from the start so that you don't have to figure this out when you're 3 or 4 years into your career.
It was timely of Rory to give you that advice. Just whenever Barry was saying there about clubs being more proactive and kind of shielding players or looking after players a little bit more, it's the potential pitfalls of that are, like, after the Munster game, for example, someone coming in the change room saying, You three there, all of you, don't look at your phones because you were really crap today. It's like, such an, you know, and so Rory sent that to you in 2018 is perfect timing. But if he'd said that to you, you know, after a bad game, then it's him acknowledging, it's him more or less telling you did not go well today, which is even more hurtful because he knows his stuff, or he knows what to anticipate.
Yeah. I start using that, like, you know, in the future, like a nice way to tell someone to get a crap game. Checking Twitter, buddy.
And your phone.
We used to. I remember Bordeaux. Do you remember Bordeaux away? I think you were on the bench, were you?
I was on the bench. Yeah, I didn't get on.
And remember, Beagle was getting a hard time on Twitter afterwards, and because we lost, we all decided to cheer ourselves up. Beagle's Paul Marshall. We decided to cheer ourselves up by searching his name on Twitter, which is not nice.
Evil. It's obviously evil. That's what it is. Yeah.
It was Tommy. It was Tommy's idea.
Or Tommy. You're a bully to me.
What about extending it further? Like, Instagram obviously isn't the type of platform to be getting criticism. But what, you know, I know you talked about how much more effective you've been with your time, or, you know, less time just sitting on the sofa, just getting lost in a rabbit hole of kind of Twitter. But what about extending that further to Instagram or other social media?
I think social media does have its place in your life, you know, as something to just, you know, when you're bored or you've nothing to do for 10 minutes to flick through, like, it's enjoyable to just kind of, like, I on my explore page, it's just like cars, just like cars and rugby. So I'm just like flicking through watching videos of, like, you know, old, like, Toyota Supras racing against Honda Civics, you know. But like, I think, like, there definitely is a place for it in that sense. And I found that Instagram, it's, people have to go to more effort to attack you on Instagram, you know, like, they need to. Oh,
time's up, is it?
Yeah.
Done. Thanks.
Coffee time.
Where did my coat? No, like, the, yeah, like, so I find that Instagram is actually quite a good place to just kind of go.
It's a positive place, yeah.
Definitely. I think it's a lot more positive than Twitter, so I haven't really found that issue with it yet. But that being said, like, I have found myself naturally probably being on social media less, just because there's, you know, there's one less app to be flipping through.
You mentioned cars there. I know you've made a recent purchase, and you've been doing a bit of work on a Mustang. Is that right?
Yeah. I got a 1966 Mustang.
Nice.
And I bought it off eBay. So it is. And it was just kind of like, yeah. It's something I wanted to do for a while. Like, I love cars, and I wanted to get, like, an older car to just be able to tinker at and do a bit of work on. So, like, Trimby, you've a Mini, don't you?
I have a mini, yeah, and I bought it maybe 12, 13 years ago, and I might have driven it a handful of times. I went to a mechanics course as well with Hendy, but I didn't really, like, it was more like changing tires and stuff, so it wasn't really massively useful. I noticed one article you did where you were talking about the Mustang, and you mentioned transmission, and straight away I was like, this guy knows his stuff.
I actually did a mechanic course online as well, but it was similar, like kind of changing tires, and you know, the car should be jacked 10 to 15 centimeters above the ground and stuff like that. So but I enjoyed it, so I might look into doing something maybe a wee bit more advanced in the future. But yeah, it's been good. Like, lockdown's been a good opportunity for me to get to a bit of work on the Mustang. So, like, I replaced the suspension in it.
Jesus.
The suspension was a scary gun, as it was, because with coil springs, you have to obviously compress them to get them out. And, like, these things, you know, these springs are used to hold up, like, a 2-ton car. So, whenever you use a special machine to compress, like, it's like four hooks, if that makes sense, like facing the opposite way from each other, and then you like just tighten it down and the hooks pull the spring together. But they do have a bit of a reputation for slipping and people losing hands or lives, so it was
Jesus.
A really nervy thing to be doing, like, but.
And where did you learn to do all that? Was that something you did as a kid?
I would always have the, like, interesting part of it, but to be honest, just off like Google and YouTube, like, there's, because Mustangs are so unbelievably popular as well, there's you know, hundreds of videos of on YouTube of doing every single thing that you'd need to know about, you know, excellent. It's a matter of YouTubing it, having a look, figuring out exactly how you do it in your car, and then doing it. So it is pretty simple.
All right, did you do a bit of work on what did you have?
I had a 1979 VW camper van, one of the old school ones, the big bay window and the bed in the back. First car I ever bought 20 years ago, I'd say. And I did have a clue, and I still don't have a clue about cars. And I remember the first week I had it, we planned on going for a holiday up the West Coast and do a load of camping stops all the way up, and got into the car Monday morning. It was our, you know, rather than going abroad, I think I was academy at the time or something like that, rather than going abroad, I was like, I'm going to stay at home, and turn on the engine. It was pissing out of the heavens, typical June morning here, and the wiper motor had broken. I was like, fuck. So obviously didn't have a clue how to do it, how to fix it or anything, but there was two little hatch windows at either side of the kind of main side windows, and you could flip them open. So I flipped them open and stuck my shoelaces out either window and tied them onto either of the wipers. And then if I pulled them this way, they'd go up. And if my girlfriend pulled them that way, they'd go down. So we're just driving like this. She was like, I'm not doing this. I was like, it's grand. And then I rang a mate of mine on the way up, and he was like, if you cut a potato in half and you put the potato juice on the windscreen, the water will, it'll create a film and the water will run around it. But there was just fucking potato juice on the window. So I stuck to my shoelace idea, and it was pretty cool. Like, because it's a flat window, you get away with it. It's not like the water kind of ran off pretty quick, but... Yeah, it was. It kept me busy throughout my half of my career. Anyway, I'd always spend a bit of time trying to learn how to, you know, even do electrics or take batteries out and stuff like that, and just do the more interior. I was more of an interior designer than the actual taking out a fucking engine or the suspension. That was not my game.
Was there a module, Jacob, on your mechanics course on potato juice?
I guess it is, though, actually.
Yeah.
Very, very nice wee bit of kind of just managing to hack your way through.
Yeah, I remember Tommy had a beetle as well, didn't he? Yeah. I remember having loads of chats with Tommy. It was the same color as that rotten snot luminous green as my one. So we used to be always chatting about it because his was Volkswagen as well. Mm. What color was yours, Jimby?
Mine was more of a bottle green. What's that?
Yeah, it's quite nice, is it?
It is. It's nice, yeah. It's I intended, whenever I finished playing, I was like, right, I'm going to spend the summer getting it sorted out. And then just never got around to it. My dad, every now and again, just it's sitting up in my garage at home. My dad, every now and again, would try and start it up. Sometimes it starts, sometimes it doesn't. The only thing we did to it was that we changed the choke. And I don't even know what.
Remember chokes?
I don't know. You remember chokes? You'd be too young for chokes, young Jacob. You wouldn't know a choke. but it was just a bit of a notion for me and never really took off. But we need to chat a little bit of potential rugby, Jacob. But actually, before we get into the rugby, tell us a little bit about you're involved in a fundraising campaign for mental health.
So Aware, are a charity partner of Maxwell, and I'd be very involved as a brand ambassador for Maxwell. So Aware came and just kind of explained to me exactly what they were doing, and I thought that it was a brilliant kind of opportunity to get involved. So they're running what they're calling the Phone a Friend campaign, which is pretty much, you know, what it says in the tin. Obviously, during lockdown, there's a lot of people who are isolating by themselves, and it can be a real tough time for a lot of people, especially people who have been living with, you know, underlying mental health conditions. And so it's just really, it's an opportunity to reach out to a friend and to, you know, just make a phone call that might make their day for kind of five or 10 minutes. And then after you've made that phone call, to then donate to Aware, you text phone a friend to 50300, and you donate €4. It's obviously a really worthwhile cause, and Aware are struggling right now in terms of fundraising because they've had to, you know, obviously cancel a lot of, you know, their fundraising events that they would have been bringing in money for.
It would make my day if you called me, Jacob, if I'm with the three kids, and I would just pretend it was a work call. Anna.
Yeah. Jacob Stockdale.
Yeah, and I was like, answer that.
It's Barry. You talk to him way too much. Don't answer that.
Yeah. No, good. I might change your name in my phone, Barry, to Jacob, and then Anna will approve me answering the call. No, we're not taking the piss. It's obviously great stuff and very good of you to get involved. And obviously kind of keeping yourself active and keeping yourself up to just doing some good out in the community, so fair play to you. Rugby wise, let's get into it. We'll get in trouble. Pat, our producer, he would have been one of the ones that would have been tweeting you in the change room in Munster, by the way. And now the thing is, he has your number, so you can delete Twitter and he'll just text it to you. So tell us a little bit, Jacob, about some of the young lads coming through Ulster. Obviously, being an Ulster supporter myself, it's been great to see what Dan McFarlane's done. He's brought a lot of young guys through, and he's got rid of a lot of dead wood, like myself. One of those guys is Stuart Moore. There's a lot of talk about him. I don't think you didn't play under 20s with him, but I'm sure you know him as a young guy coming through. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, he's a serious talent. Like he's one of those players that. You know, just everything seems to come naturally to him, like really good passer, kicker, like good feet. You know, he's a very, very talented all rounder. And I think he's actually, like, from what I can gather, he's been working pretty hard over this lockdown period. Like he ran a 4:25 Bronco there, which is quick for, you know, for a center especially. So you know,
how does that compare then to where would that be in the pecking order?
I think he was second.
Really?
Shanner's,
really?
Yeah. I think Shanner's beat him, but you know, so he's right up there in terms of like his fitness, which would probably have been one of his weaker areas. you know, like kind of earlier on, in his career. So he's really shaping himself up to be a very talented player, and there's no doubt that he'll get plenty of caps for Ulster.
It might have been his first touch for his first game away at the RDS, and he produced the most ridiculous offload. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. Supposedly, no, I wasn't there, but apparently before he was going on Graham Peele, the message that Peele sent down was just like, keep it in the hands, like, see it, no offloads like that. His first touch of was out of his horse, like, so he's a seriously talented B man.
Yeah, and then speaking of talent, obviously Albie Mathewson, Ian Madigan, what's the story on those boys? Do you know much about them? Have you obviously never played with Madigan, but what's your thoughts on them coming in?
Yeah, they've come in, obviously they're like, I suppose they're, you know, part of the team now, although realistically it doesn't feel like it that much just because we're not together, but been involved in a few like Zoom calls and like meetings for talking about like backfield defense and talking about, you know, really just trying to talk about rugby to keep mind occupied a bit. But you know, they've come with some really good points and they've added a lot and contributed to the conversations they've been involved in so far. So I know there's only so much that they can really add to the Ulster right now, but you know, it bodes well for whenever they come back in, you know, like full time training, that they'll definitely bring, you know, a level of experience to the team, which is exciting.
And then looking forward, then obviously it looks like Interpros in August. Interpros, like it to me, all being of the one stadium, it reminds me of like a mini rugby tournament. You know, you Ulster guys go and change over in that. There'll be a wee tent, you know, and everybody gets their wee assigned spot. But so looking forward, that's the next rugby we've got to look forward to.
We'll all stay in each other's houses. Everyone will stay in like Leinster players' houses.
Yeah. Have you let
yourself... Hope I don't get the weird family. Oh god. I remember going to I went to Coleraine as an underage player, and I thought it might have been your house because we went to some play. Everyone else went to like the Jetland Center and going ice skating and shit. Jet Center, and I had to go to some Fiddler on the Roof play. I was like 10 years of age. What is going on here? Might not have been your house, but I assume that's what you'd have been up to.
We'll track that person down. Say again, Jacob.
I can definitely see the Trimbles rocking down.
What is it like? What is it about me that says Fiddler on the Roof? But have you let yourself think about rugby, Jacob, or looking forward to Interpros, or have you even thought a little bit potentially about Lions next summer?
Yes to all those questions. To be honest, like I'm obsessed with rugby. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I wasn't playing it, like I'd be a fan. So. Like, I've watched every game, I'd say pretty much every game that I've played in the last 4 years so far over lockdown. Like, so it's been, yeah, it's just something I enjoy doing. And then obviously looking forward, like, there's that date that we've been given now, it's 22nd of August. So obviously, you know, realistically, I hope that we're playing because I'm itching to get back on the pitch in any degree. So, yeah, I'm hoping that we'll be back at that date. In terms of the Lions, like, yeah, it's the kind of thing that's always going to be in the back of your head a wee bit. you know, there's obviously a lot of rugby to be played between now and then, and you know, if the team was getting picked now, I don't know if I would be picked or not. But like, just by the time, you know, Warren Gatland's making a selection, like, I want to be in the position where like it's a no brainer that he has to have me, you know, and that can't be done in, you know, in a matter of 8 months. So that's the plan anyway.
Yeah, good
that's
man.
That's so interesting. You're watching every game back, man. I absolutely love that. So you've got a lot to choose from, but what would be your highlight, or give us your top three highlights so far watching back over the lockdown?
Funny, like they're probably not what would have expected, because I think like from watching games over the years, like the stuff that you're like, there's obviously stuff that you remember, you know, like the Twickenham try or the, you know, beating New Zealand or, you know, these big games that you remember playing in. But there's a few games that I'd kind of forgotten about, which looking back, I was like, that was a class game. You know, there was a game we played at the end of the season for Ulster against Glasgow. I was on the bench. Trevor, you might have started that game. I'm not sure.
Remember.
I was on the bench and then Louis Ludic got injured about 15 minutes in, and I came on to 13 playing outside Luke Marshall, and scored two tries that day. Like, and I remember like the game was like, it was a phenomenal game, and I'd kind of completely forgotten about it, so it was nice getting, you know, reminded about the games that don't stick in the memory as much as others do, you know.
Yeah, I know. There's been a lot of classic matches on, so I've been allowed to do that as well. And I agree, it is those little moments that you kind of forget about. It's funny what you do, what does stand out. But yeah, look, I think I can't wait to see you back playing, man, when this all kicks off. And I think we've taken up loads of your time, Trimby, unless you've got anything to add.
No. Good stuff. Great to hear you're kind of taking a trip down memory lane and enjoying the nostalgia that myself and Barry are doing as well. We've got to go back and review the All Blacks game where we beat them in Chicago 2016, and obviously you beat the All Blacks, and maybe Barry, you know, you go back and review the time that you nearly, remember the time you nearly nearly beat them that time, remember?
No, not sure.
But Jacob, listen, great to have you on the show. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Cheers, guys. Thanks for having me.
COVID-19 or coronavirus is here. By taking a few simple steps, we can slow the virus down and help protect everyone. Wash your hands more often, for at least 20 seconds with soap and water. If you cough or sneeze, use a tissue or cover your mouth with your elbow, then bin the tissue and wash your hands. Avoid touching your eyes, nose and mouth, and keep surfaces clean. Distance yourself at least 2 meters, 6 feet away from other people, especially those who might be unwell. Stop shaking hands or hugging when saying hello or greeting other people. For updated factual information and advice, go to hse.ie or call 1850 24 1850. Protection from coronavirus. It's in our hands.
Okay, welcome back to part 3. Over the weekend, we gave you all your classic homework to do, which means each week we'll be discussing a classic movie, album and rugby match. And we're taking you back to June 1995 this week, where we're going to start with probably the thing that reminds me most of that time of my life was the 1995 World Cup. It took over my life for that month of May and June. And probably the most outstanding result, and still one of the most outstanding results in any World Cup semi-final, was New Zealand beating the absolute bollocks out of England in Johannesburg in the semi-final, where Jonah Lomu really, I think, rose to proper stardom. Mm-hmm. Correct?
Oh, Jonah Lomu, like, it seems the most obvious thing in the world for us to talk about Jonah Lomu, but it was just crazy how much head and shoulders, how far ahead of everyone he was. It's mad.
Four tries, and literally, I don't know if anyone actually tackled him. I don't think they did in the whole time, entire game.
Yeah, just looked easy. Very easy.
He probably only touched the ball like 6 or 7 times, put one nice left foot spiral in as well. But yeah, they could have given him the ball all the time, like you would when you were an underage and you had one giant player. But they seemed to do it sparingly, like they were playing with their food, kind of like your cat would be playing with the mouse outside. Although then when you look at like standout performances in, like going through the team, the Brooke brothers, pretty class. Bash up, Walter
drop
Little.
Goal. The drop goal from Brooke.
Zins and Brooke, man. Like, they don't make number 8s anymore like that. He didn't kick it
like he's been practicing drop goals. It didn't look like a natural kind of swipe, but it took off. It just soared. It was halfway, wasn't it? Halfway on 15, maybe.
It was 40 meters. So it was it was on the 10 meter line and on the 15, which is at least 40 meters and probably more. But yeah, he would have gotten that from his own half if it was directly in front. But he then had at one point in the second half, he caught the ball. I think it spilled out the back of a scrum, and he put in a right foot spiral that actually went directly into touch. And then 30 seconds later, he gets the ball and puts in a left foot spiral, which actually rolled into touch. And he had another brilliant 25-yard pass for one of Lomu's tries. But my favorite to be honest, was the start where the kickoff, Mertens is taking the kickoff, and he looks like he's shaping up to kick it to the forwards, and then he just turns and kicks it kicks it for Lomu, and you can just imagine 73 kg or Underwood and Will Carling dropping down on top of him, and you can literally see them just go shitting themselves. They run into each other and they both just they'll just fall over, and Lomu just kind of tramples on both of them and picks him up, and he scores within 90 seconds of the kickoff.
Put it anywhere near him. Who was it? Who threw the ball for the famous try of the four? Who was it? Threw it.
Basham.
Chucked it over his head, bounced a couple of times. As long as it goes somewhere near Lomu, we should probably score all right.
Yeah, and then obviously the most famous attempted tackle I've ever seen was my cat. The poor bugger just gets absolutely trampled. And I love the commentator who he was, but his reaction is so genuinely astounding. He's like, he's like, what have I just seen? And then Lomu slams it down. Man, I remember that so clearly watching it. I remember what seat I was sitting in my house and just being like, oh my goodness, here he is. This is rugby, where it should be and how it should be played. You know, he's 120 kgs.
What? No. Yeah. Was he?
Yeah. Yeah. His legs are tree trunks. And he's up against 73 kg winger. So when he catches Tony Underwood a few times, or Rory Underwood, one of them, and he just swings.
Shirt swings. Yeah. It was Rory, wasn't it? On the right.
Yeah.
And he tries to just stick him and go. And he looks so confident. And it's such fake confidence. There's no way he's actually confident there. Lomu just goes. He could have thrown him into the crowd. He could have landed three or four rows back. like a hammer throw.
You're right, he was fairly kind. He just kind of threw him up against the boards and he kind of looks over his shoulder as he's running off and just kind of smirks at him. But you think, because Underwood has a couple of yards head start in him as well, and he's obviously lightning fast. You're imagining when you're watching it going, oh, whoa, does he actually burn him? No, he absolutely does not burn him. So yeah, watching that back was phenomenal. And there's a couple of brilliant moments, man. What's the English coach's name? Can you remember Jack Rowell? Do you remember him?
No.
He looked like John Major, kind of like a politician, very much like a politician. It was bizarre watching him up in the stand. But after 20 minutes, watched his back. After 20 minutes, the camera flips to him, and New Zealand have scored their third try and drop goals. So they're about 27-0 up, and I think it's the most England have ever been beaten by in a test match is by 27 points, and all of a sudden they're 27 points down after 20 minutes, and the camera flicks to him, right, and he's in the stand and he's sitting at the edge of a row of seats, and the commentator's like, Jack Rowell, well, looking well, and then Jack, as the camera's on him, this lady walks past him on the steps, walks down, and Jack Rowell sticks the head out and kind of checks her arse out as just as the commentator kind of pauses, Jack Rowell looking well, and then the head goes out rather composed, really. It's phenomenal. But yeah, I even enjoyed they have their half time on the pitch.
Oh really? Oranges?
And he's just standing there And you're like, this guy is doing nothing. He's not saying, although what are you going to say when you're that far down? But yeah, look, it was it was an unbelievable, like at the birth of Lomu, which was, you know, probably still my favorite thing about rugby of all time, that he existed and played, and what a man. And what a team. Unfortunately, though, didn't go on to win it. But, well, not unfortunately. I actually, another thing, do you remember Walter Little and Frank Bunce, the 12-13 for New Zealand at the time?
Mm-hmm.
I was obsessed with them. One of the reasons I wanted to be a centre, watching them. But one of the other reasons was my dad had given me a jersey, a New Zealand number 12 with a 12 on the back. Do you remember how rare it was? You wouldn't get, if you had like a jersey bought in a shop, it would never have a number on it, but it had a number 12 stitched into it. And he told me it was Walter Little's jersey. And I was like, when I was a kid, I was like, unbelievable. So I remember telling everyone this, obviously down to my knees, and I wore it occasionally, like, but I kept it quite safe. So he tells me the other day that he was running a raffle for a trip to New Zealand to raise money for Bose. And he bought the jersey and got someone in the feckin' suit repair place in town to stitch on a number 12 jersey, and then raffled it off saying that it was Frank Bunce's jersey or Walter Little's jersey, and made a few hundred quid for the club or something like that. And it also must have fixed it that he won the raffle as well, because how else did it end up in my house? So I've been going around for fucking 30 years telling everyone that that was Walter Little's jersey. But.
Oh, Dad, just hustling people. That's the second week in a row you've told hustling stories about your dad. And he's come clean. He came clean last week. Another like bit of him coming clean. So he obviously then reveals that to you in later life. If that behavior continues, and as your life goes on, you realize Dad's been lying about this, Dad's been lying about that. And then 10 years time, he'll be like, I'm not even your dad.
When he runs off with Neil Briggs and they start their counterfeit clothing company. And I'll be like, Dad, take me with you. And he's like, I'm not even your dad.
Yeah. Very good.
Yeah. Good stuff. Chancer. All right. Well, look, that's our game. It's on YouTube. Go watch it. Very, very, very enjoyable. Moving on swiftly. Braveheart. What are your memories?
Braveheart, 1995, directed by and starring Mel Gibson, winner of 5 Oscars. One for best makeup, which, you know... Yeah,
that's just the blue paint.
It's the blue paint, yeah. I assume it's the blue paint. We'll do a strip in his face. That's our that's one Oscar.
Fair.
Who's going to count for the other 4 Oscars? Either that or maybe young William... kind of, they do a really good job of making him look really dirty and kind of unkempt. And I can identify with that at the minute, because during isolation, don't know about you, but I rarely shower. I feel like I've got a whiff of young William about me. Jack came into me the other morning, and I was like, come here, give me a cuddle. And then he was there 5 seconds, and he goes, Daddy, you stink.
You smell like a 12th century Scottish child that hasn't washed in years.
You should win an Oscar, Daddy.
For how much you smell.
Yeah, but Braveheart it seemed to get critical acclaim at the time. And I remember the time thinking, wow, like the battle sequences were incredible, legs chopped off. There was a lot of joy. A lot of fighters got a lot of joy out of smashing guys on the wee tin helmets, almost like the Fez hats that Saracens used to wear. Saracens supporters, like a tin version of that, and then just blood down their face. That was a regular one.
They had a tomato underneath their hat. They hit it and just squash, or a sachet of ketchup.
Yeah, so
that was the makeup.
Apparently, I read up, and apparently they actually removed a lot of the violence from it. It was too violent. Mel Gibson went back and edited.
Jesus, there's one where a guy gets a sword up the nose. Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. And he goes, that's my nose.
That's mine.
No. Jeez, you don't get much more violent. And the one, the Irish guy stabs a guy up through the dick. Just goes, whoop, and you see it coming out the other side, up his skirt.
Oh, like. Yes, that's right, yeah. anyway, the other thing is, so apparently, though, it got critical acclaim for all those reasons. But it was...
That's because there was no Google back in 1995.
Historically, apparently, it was absolute chaos. And then you pointed out to me, I was watching it, I rewatched it last night. It was maybe an hour and a half into it, and you texted me and said, it's actually a comedy. And I went, no, it all makes sense.
That's it. I mean, I was thinking about it. If you watch Friends, right, and you take out the laughing of Friends, Friends becomes less funny because the laughing is just like a cue. Ha ha ha, that was a funny part. If you took the laughing out of Friends and put it into Braveheart, it would be like Monty Python and the Holy Grail. It's so ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. I thought there was moments it's like a carry-on movie, isn't it? Mm,
Longshanks, like, how amazing a character. How evil, like, could you possibly portray the English king, like, to be? He's a pagan, he's homophobic, he's, like, allows prima nocta to happen. He's just, like, when he throws your man out the window, that's comedy, like, isn't it?
Yeah, that's comedy. The reaction from the guards at the bottom is comedy as well. they all rush over like there's an emergency. They look up and they go, not to worry. That's fine.
I've appointed Philip the head of my high council. I am skilled in the arts of war and military tactics. Are you? Yeah, let's see what you would make in this current situation. Fucks him out the window.
Yeah, the other thing, there was a... refreshingly, again, nostalgia, there was a lot of stone throwing captured a large part of my childhood. Stone throwing, that the skill of stone throwing was very, very high up the list of your kind of your social currency, like how valuable you were, like if you could throw a good stone, like that made you in the cool crowd. Or
which you've got a bit of a catapult arm, so you must have been pretty good with you.
I was going to say throw like a girl, but I can't say that
anymore. Can't say that.
I throw like a person.
Yeah, a poor person. Not a poor person. Shit.
You can say nothing. So stone throwing. I hope, obviously, there's no iPads when we were growing up. There were no internet, I suppose, as well. So we threw stones. I hope that my kids still throw stones, though. I hope they kind of bring that onto the next generation and pass that skill down. It's very important. I think one other issue, one thing I picked up on was the Scots were always going into battle. The Scots were very clumsily dressed. I thought they didn't do themselves any favors. Like if someone, and it reminded me a little bit of the 95 World Cup with the baggy jerseys and all, I'm thinking if someone had got a 2020 World Cup jersey, brought that back to the Scots in 1995 when they were fighting and giving
that, would fit in with the historic inaccuracies if one of them was wearing a 1995 Nike Irish jersey.
Yeah, so I just felt like they could have done themselves a few more favors there. I think Wallace should have, his speech was very rousing, but it wasn't very practical. He should have said, they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom. Oh, by the way, no kilts, fellas. No tartan. Don't have any shit hanging off you, lads. We have to run full pelt here with swords. Someone's going to hurt themselves. So, yeah,
your sword snagged in someone else's little hanky thing.
Yeah. So I don't think they helped themselves there. Wear something more sensible, I think, should have been William Wallace's speech.
Yeah. I don't know if that would have had the same impact. Look, to be fair, if you take it as a bit of fiction, and if it was just a fictional story, which is like, obviously you can come on here and be like a complete like douche and be like, it's so historically inaccurate and all that. I'm sure they're aware of it by the time. But you're like, it was so well put together, cinematically brilliant and all that. But how much of it has, you know, do people actually believe that this is what happened? Do you reckon, like, it's gone on 20 years, 25 years now. People must be still thinking,
this is how it happened. This is how evil all of the English were, which obviously over here it's easy for us to believe that. But apparently, if you look into it, it's completely historically accurate.
They were really signed.
Like even the princess wasn't even born or something like that, or she was maybe an infant when all of this happened. That's quite weird as well, isn't it?
It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
Bruce, or what's it? Bruce Willis. Mel Gibson can do whatever he wants. And what was the Pauly and Hazy? Yeah,
I remember you talking about, I can't remember, and I don't think you remember either, so this might be a dead end, but I remember there was some illustration or comparison between Wallace and Hamish having the stone throwing competition. And then it's O'Connell and Hayes was Hamish, and he was like throwing the stone. He was like, "You'll move," and he's like, "I will not." I can't remember what this is like. A previous episode, like a year and a half ago, I remember you had some comparison, and I loved it at the time. I've just forgotten it.
Shit, I've forgotten as well. But yeah, superb film. To be fair. Always a good watch. And then to tie up that, what would have been happening at the time as they were bringing that out and we were watching New Zealand hammer England and the Scots hammer England, Oasis dropped their second album. What's the Story? Morning Glory. Probably their best album. Do you agree?
I really like Definitely Maybe, but it's definitely their most successful album, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when you look, it is. It's, I think, it was number one for like 10 weeks or something like that. So that's probably financially would have. But then you look at the songs and fuck, it's so well put together, man. Jesus. So albums like this, I think, had to live with a live vibe as well. So they were going out playing in stadiums and big festivals and crack like that. So they have loads of banging tunes, even like the instrumental tunes in it are so upbeat and rousing that you can imagine them, like, such an important part of a gig where, like, in between songs, the band aren't going, "And now for my next song." You know, that can be a shitty part to any gig. So to have just an instrumental part that bangs on through and lets people keep the energy up, and then you just drop into feckin' Wonderwall. Is there a more memorable four chord guitar part in the planet? Probably not.
No, that's it. It would have been a very popular one for on the bus, singing on the bus. I always think that yellow container you drink from, I always think it looks like you're drinking bleach.
Anyway. It's water, funny enough.
A popular one for on the bus. And would have been maybe outlawed actually in a couple of teams. You sing any song you want, but not that.
I think everyone overdid it. If I was to pick a song on it, some might say is, I don't know, there's something about it. It's so unique. And I was reading up on it. They recorded it live in like one take with everyone. Not one take, but it was a take for everyone. So, when they listened back to it, when Noel listened back to it and he was drunk, and I think Bonehead maybe, they were listening, which is often what I do when we write and record songs. I listen back to them drunk. It gives you a different perspective. And they were listening back to it and they realized that it gets way faster in the chorus than it did in the verses. So they wanted to re-record it. But Liam's vocals were so good on it that they didn't want to, the rest of the band outvoted them. And if you listen to it, like, we've grown with it, obviously. We don't know it any different. So it's clearly gets faster in the chorus, which is bizarre, but it's banging. It's almost like it needs it. It just kicks on a little bit, which is obviously a mistake, and they had to like drown it in reverb and stuff, but it's, for me, fucking flawless. It's funny how you can have mistakes and they can end up being maybe the most beautiful part of the song.
She's Electric was my favorite song on it.
Was it?
I'd say probably This is the album that everybody knows more or less all the words for most of the songs.
I was like, I know every word to probably, maybe not Hey Now, but I know 9 of the songs, 10 of the songs, I know every word to it.
Yeah.
That's some. Think, that is some ability to write a song, isn't it? An album that everyone know the words.
After, I think it was after last week or a couple of weeks ago, Pat said that I'm like very close to the camera. And that's a little bit like the way Liam sings. You know, he does that thing where he's right up. So I feel like I've been kind of, it's been a tribute to Liam over the last
Liam
few weeks.
Gallagher. Yeah. His vocals on this are unbelievable, but I do love that this is when you first hear Noel coming in. He sings Don't Look Back in Anger. That's his first time that he does lead vocals for an Oasis track. And it was kind of I think he started to take over a little bit more then. We actually, have you seen Supersonic, the film?
Yeah.
So do you remember the part when they were recording this album? They're in Rockfield Studios in Wales.
Yeah, you told me this. Farm. You recorded, yeah.
Yes, we recorded one of our records there about 5 years ago. And it's an unbelievable place. Just like literally a farm in the middle of the Welsh countryside. And there's an old farmer there who's been there since the 60s. Well, he grew up there, but he was a studio since the 60s. His name's Kingsley. And he runs the place and he's just wandering around the place. He'd stop in the middle of the studio when you're in the middle of recording, and he'd bring in a feckin' bucket of milk because he's just been, milking the cows. And he'll just sit down and start talking, and everything has to stop, and you listen to him. And he was telling us stories about, like, what's his name? Freddie Mercury writing Bohemian Rhapsody there. Uh-huh. And he's like, just see that wind chime out there. I remember Freddie was sitting there and he was playing the piano and I looked up and he looked like he was stuck for a line, and I looked up and I said, "See that wind chime there? Any way the wind blows, that blows." And then that's where he got the line for "Any Way the Wind Blows" for Bohemian Rhapsody. And he said, "You see that wall out there? That's the Wonderwall. That's where Noel was sitting when he wrote the Wonderwall." And then sure enough, like a couple of days later, a load of people came in and sat up on the wall. And this is now, man, middle of nowhere. A load of people are sitting up on the wall, taking photos of themselves on the wall. And of course, we did as well. We were out there fucking taking selfies on it. No way he wrote that there. Like,
no, he's your man. Like he sounds like Ralla.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Just kind of holding chord, taking his time, telling stories. Yeah. Yeah. That's important.
He had the audacity to come out and say Chris Martin was here and he was writing for Coldplay, writing Parachutes, and he was stuck for us, so I couldn't think of a line. And we were outside and we were having a cigarette, and I looked up and I pointed at the stars and I said, "Hey Chris, see those stars there, boy? They shine for you." So he got the line for Yellow. It's like, this is bullshit, but I love it. So yeah, it was great. It was cool when going back to a studio like that, man, and you can feel it in the walls, though. That's why when someone comes in and starts telling those stories, and it hasn't been changed a bit, like, watch Supersonic, the exact same vibe around the place. So yeah, that was 1995, ladies and gentlemen. June. What a time to be alive. Yeah.
Do a quick roundup.
Shouldn't be any penguins. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, Penguins have been a little bit quiet. But this week, the Penguin of the Week goes to Patrick Corrigan, who shared a ridiculous Penguins in Vietnam video from Japan.
Saw that.
Pat was traumatized. It's like Platoon. There's penguins getting mowed down left, right, and center. It's strange whenever you see, like, it's so, like, an animal that we all consider to be, especially us, because we're all kind of, we have an affinity with penguins now. There's a cuteness and a closeness and just a loveliness about wee fluffy penguins. Molly has a penguin teddy, right? And then you put them in a sinister situation like Vietnam, getting shot by machine guns. Very strange.
You're crying watching this anime cartoon.
Yeah, but that was brilliant, I must say. Good stuff. One other, who was it? Someone put into the group. They're using this like as like a community to, well, no, that, to be fair, that's what it is. But I think this one was taking the piss. Someone was looking for a dentist in the group to help them out.
Was it a rugby related injury, or is he just looking for a dentist?
He's just looking for a dentist.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, so if it'd be good if it was kept. You know what? I was going to say rugby themed. No, actually, you know what? Actually, Inquiring about dentists is more on our brand, I think. So
Penguin Dentist. If there's a dentist for penguins, get him on. That's yeah. There was also a guy, an American rugby player, who's selling himself, essentially. He sent in his video clips looking to come over here and play some rugby, which I fully support that as well.
Yeah.
Although his footage was taken on an iPhone from the side of the field, which may not help, but still enjoyed it.
It's probably naive to think that we can pull any strings, but
yeah,
we'll do what we can for you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But, so also Matt McKnight seems to have a cartoon on the way with the field and the fox.
Yes, I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah, and the mouse and the cat. So Penguin of the Week was who?
Patrick Corrigan.
Well done.
Well done, buddy.
Alrighty. Cool. Look, that's it. That's more than enough, lads, to keep you going for another week. Thank you all for listening, and thank you everyone watching over on our new YouTube channel. And a big thanks to everyone for putting the show together, to Pat, to Paul, to Dermot, and to Anthony. This has been Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby here on Joe, together with Guinness. Party on, Trimby.
Party on.
You were listening to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie for the facts.